Kent Online News.
News you can trust.
This is the Kent Online Podcast. Kate Faulkner.
Hello, hope you're okay. Thank you for downloading today's podcast on Wednesday, October 16th. Coming up today, we'll hear from the boss of Eurotunnel, who says passengers will have to pay more to recover money spent on new border checks that have now been delayed. We'll also hear from a man who claims bailiffs turned up at his house to collect on a parking fine in Medway he knew nothing about. But first, taking a look at our top story today. It's been confirmed one person has died following a three-car crash on the M20. Lucy has more details for the Kent Online podcast.
Emergency services were called to the M20 near Junction 1 at around 6:15 this morning. Police say a dark blue smart car was travelling on the coastbound carriageway when it was involved in a collision with a blue Vauxhall Mokka. The same smart car was then involved in another crash with a BMW on the slip road from the M25 where it joins the M20. Ambulance crews confirmed the driver died at the scene. He's believed to be a man in his 20s and his family have been informed. Now, both lanes of the M20 were initially closed in both directions between junctions 1 and 3. The London-bound stretch later reopened, but at the time of recording today's podcast, the coastbound carriageway was still closed to allow for investigations. Officers have made an appeal for witnesses to come forward and want to speak to anyone with dashcam footage.
Now, that's not the only serious crash on Kent's roads today. A man's been taken to hospital following a crash on the M2. Nicola has more details.
Emergency crews were called to the coastbound carriageway of the M2 just before 8 this morning. It's believed two lorries had collided between junctions 2 and 3. Three of the four lanes were closed from junction 2, which is for Stroud and Rochester, to junction 3, which is for Chatham and Rochester. Now, the closures led to 6 miles of tailbacks on the motorway. Paramedics were also at the scene and treated one man for his injuries before he was taken to a local hospital for further medical treatment. It's not yet known just how bad his injuries are.
Thanks, Nicola. You can find updates on both of these stories at Kent Online. Taking a look at another of our top stories today, the head of the National Association of Funeral Directors has backed calls for urgent regulation in the wake of the David Fuller inquiry. Fuller was working as a maintenance worker at two Kent hospitals when he abused more than 100 bodies in mortuaries. A report has outlined the need for an independent regulator. Our colleague Bartholomew from KMTV has been speaking to Andrew Judd, who agrees.
We're really supportive of the findings of the Fuller inquiry thus far, phase two, because we absolutely believe that all bereaved families and all deceased people should be treated with consistent levels of care and respect. The reality is about 70% of the funerals that take place in the UK are actually conducted under the scrutiny of either our trade association, and there are other trade associations. So the public can be very reassured that if they're using a funeral director, wherever they are, if they're a member of a trade association, they are under that watchful eye of standards and compliance. However, I think what the Fuller inquiry brings out and what we've been saying for a long time, it's the funeral directors that aren't members of any trade association or for whatever reason have left a trade association, they can still trade. So there's that sort of 30% gap, if you like, at the moment, which we don't think's right. Obviously, David Fuller's crimes were committed by an electrician in an NHS setting. That's what started all of this off. But as funeral directors, we care about deceased wherever they are, whether they're in a hospital setting or a care home or a funeral director's own premises. Every death matters and every deceased matters. So what we would like to see is that the standards and the requirements of members in our trade association apply across the whole piece. And we genuinely think that it is absolutely time for the government to regulate in a statutory way so that there is a register of funeral directors, so that as in Scotland, who've already put this in place, that there's a license. And, you know, 60% of the people in the UK actually think funeral directors are already regulated. But the reality is anybody can be a funeral director. You don't have to have any training. We provide training and professional qualifications, but that's only going to appeal to those people that care about what they do. So the reality is, we, you know, if people must choose a funeral director very carefully.
Kent Online News.
A former employee at a children's home in Kent is on trial accused of sexually abusing young boys. Duncan Bales is said to have carried out the attacks at homes in Deal and Ramsgate more than 30 years ago. The 64-year-old, who lives in Margate High Street, denies the charges. Proceedings are expected to take between 2 and 3 weeks. Two men will appear in court today, charged with the murder of a 23-year-old man in Canterbury city centre. Kamel Ibrahim, who's 24 and from Longacre Close in the city, is due at Canterbury Crown Court, along with Mohammed Hagar, who's 31 and doesn't have a permanent address. The victim has been named as Samir Garis Kahir, who died after being attacked late last Thursday night. Meanwhile, a Medway woman will go on trial next year, accused of the murder of a man in a block of flats. The victim was found with stab wounds in an apartment in Gun Lane in Strood in July. Nina Mercer, who's 42 and lives in the street, denies the charges. The hearing will get underway in February. Police have been sprayed with a fire extinguisher during a car chase from Rochester towards Maidstone. Officers followed an uninsured vehicle that was being driven dangerously along the A229 in the early hours of yesterday. The car eventually collided with bollards on East Malling High Street. Two men in their 20s have been arrested. A driver who smoked cannabis the night before he crashed into a cyclist near Folkestone has avoided prison. Clive Williams mounted the pavement in Canterbury Road in Hawkinge in April last year, leaving the bike rider with life-changing injuries. The 41-year-old from St Andrew's Close in Folkestone received a suspended sentence. He's been banned from driving, must do 200 hours of unpaid work and pay more than £200.
Kent Online News.
Prices could increase at the Channel Tunnel as bosses look to recover money spent on new border checks, which have now been delayed. The EU's entry-exit system was due to come into force for passengers in November, but instead it'll be phased in next year. John Keefe is from Getlink Group, which operates Eurotunnel. He's been questioned by Lord Foster of Bath while giving evidence at the Justice and Home Affairs Committee about what will happen to the extra staff they've hired.
We'll have to carry that cost. We can't simply recruit people and then lay them off again. So we will maintain those staff that we've recruited. We'll cycle them through various different other jobs because they'll all be multi-skilled on the terminal. And we'll drill them through the process by using the routing on the terminal for cars that we've built over the last 2 years. And then we'll iron out any sort of small bugs that are in that process. But we will train them, we'll drill them, and we'll rotate them through other roles as well.
And you've already spent millions of pounds on getting everything ready for the 10th of November, and these additional costs will obviously have implications for the company.
They will. We were looking forward to starting to recover that cost from the 10th of November. We'll be sitting with 80 million euros spent, so let's call it 70 million pounds spent, to develop the technology, to build the infrastructure, to do the modelling using artificial intelligence, to install all of the kiosks that we had specially built to operate in the vehicle environment. And all of that will have to be put into hibernation whilst we wait for the day. So that's a cost that we will have to carry because of this delay.
And how would you be recovering this cost anyway?
Until we go live, there's no way to cover the cost.
Once you do, how do you recover the cost?
A cost like this inevitably is passed on to the consumer. Everything that we do to improve the journey of our customers, in one way or another, gets passed on.
Kent Police and Crime Commissioner says his office helped more than 100,000 victims last year. That's a rise of 2% compared to the previous year. Matthew Scott's team has also secured funding to support people affected by domestic abuse, stalking and hate crime. It comes as Kent Police have been at pubs and clubs across Thanet as part of their safer socialising operation. They're working to tackle drug-related crime and turned up at venues in Ramsgate, Margate and Broadstairs to make sure they were adhering to licensing conditions. Cannabis and Class A drugs were also seen seized as part of the patrols. Now, Kent campaigners are among those gathering outside Parliament today as a private members' bill is introduced to change the law around assisted dying. It's expected to lead to a debate by MPs on whether to offer a choice at the end of life for people with terminal illnesses. The Archbishop of Canterbury has warned it could lead to a slippery slope. Our reporter Alex Langridge has been speaking to Gareth Ward, whose terminally ill father took his own life.
3 years ago now, my terminally ill father decided that he could no longer continue to live with the amount of pain that he was in and endure the suffering anymore. So he took his legally owned shotgun and he took his own life, effectively, to end that suffering. Obviously, that's quite a shocking thing to do. And I sort of thought, because I had a lot of, like, maybe a lot of emotion around that sort of thing, I'd try and channel it into something positive. So I sort of started Googling and stuff like that, and I literally stumbled on the Dignity in Dying campaign. So I sent them my story, and then they got back in touch with me, and ever since then, been using Dad's story to help change the law for other people.
And do you think, obviously, if he had the option available to him, he would have chosen to do sort of go down the assisted dying route instead of the way that he did, sadly?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it wasn't something that we exactly discussed, but if the choice was open to him to be able to, you know, check out in a calm, quiet way whereby he could say properly to us, to his family and everything like that, as opposed to sitting alone in his back garden and phoning me up and saying, right, that's it, I can't take another night like last night, I'm going to shoot myself now. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious which one he'd choose, you know. No one would choose such an explosive, sad, horrible end to their own life if there was a better alternative.
And I know you said, obviously, using that to kind of help others that might be in this, you know, who maybe have terminal illnesses. So why do you think it's important to maybe have this option? Is it about choice, how to end your own life?
Yeah, very much so. And compassion, really, to sort of, you know, to try and stop people suffering. I mean, my dad was, it's a horrible thing to say, but he looked like a dead man walking for at least 6 months. I sort of made this joke before. It was almost like he was dead already, but someone forgot to tell him. It was horrible to see him. You know, I don't mean that. I love my dad. I'd love to see him still. But do you know what I mean? To see him in so much pain all the time. You know, so it is about that choice. And, you know, it's not. I know that some people are in opposition for whatever their reasons. You know, sometimes those reasons are religious. Sometimes they're other things. But it's, for me, it's about personal choice. If you don't wish to do or to have that option open to you, if and when, you know, sadly, you're in extreme pain at the very end of your life, you don't need to choose it if you have, you know, religious beliefs that would stop you from doing that. But I truly believe that as a society and, you know, globally is going in this direction, really, you know, very specifically, when you're terminally ill and you're at the end of your life, you know, you should be allowed to take a decision to end your suffering sooner rather than being kept artificially alive by science and living out your last few days in a whole world of pain. It seems crazy to me.
And obviously the reason we're having this conversation is because later this week the bill's going to kind of be tabled in Parliament. What do you hope is going to happen later this week? You know, how do you hope to see sort of discussions go?
Well, I've actually been invited to go to a demonstration on Wednesday at Parliament, just before. It's Kim Leadbeater, I think. She's the person that's going to be sort of, you know, it's going to be a first reading of that. So we're going to have a small demonstration outside just to show some support. But, you know, I hope, I naturally understand there's going to be resistance, you know, there's going to be people for it, people against it, people whose minds can be changed, you know. I just hope that the debate is given long enough in Parliament to reach its fruition, because previously it was read in Parliament and I think other sort of extenuating circumstances at the time, other things going on in the world might have sort of overshadowed it and it was just sort of put to the side. So what I really, really hope is that, you know, long enough is given to debate, you know, the sorts of whys and wherefores of how it might work and how we might be able to put the safeguards in place that would, you know, that would mitigate the concerns of those politicians and perhaps members of the public that are concerned.
Kent Online News.
The Kent Online podcast has been hearing from a man who claims he'd been wrongly hounded by bailiffs for hundreds of pounds over a parking ticket he knew nothing about. Wilson Chowdhury took a family trip to Rochester for a day out during the King's Coronation Bank holiday in May last year. He parked on a street he thought was free. A year later, bailiffs turned up at his door. He paid more than £500, but later took Medway Council to court to prove that postal issues in his town in Essex meant he'd not had a single penalty fine or letter through the door. He was even sent a bill for an extra £70 on top of the bailiff charges. It was later judged he should only have to pay the original parking fine and was due a refund for the rest. But Wilson has told our reporter Ellie Hodgson he's still not seen it.
I think I'm at my wit's end, if that's the right word, or my final straw. But, you know, I've been as patient as I can, considering I actually forgot about it. And my memory of those monies that are owed to me have been triggered by a further bill that has, they may say innocuously, I doubt it, it's a system error. How many times has that system error occurred? It'd be interesting to know. A blatant, incorrectly applied additional charge to me seems like an error too much. And yeah, it's frustrating. It makes me angry. It makes me upset. But more to the point, I'm still left in a situation where I don't know when I'm actually going to receive these funds. It could be after Christmas when you think about how long I've had to wait for all of these. Whereas that money could actually help with buying my children Christmas presents. You know, I'd rather have it now. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course. So they didn't say that they've sort of issued the refund and it would be a certain amount of working days or anything like
They've given me absolutely no information. So I have no idea. They haven't even responded to the email. Look, it's 5 days. How long does the council need to respond to that? And actually then to say, oh, yes, we do owe you money. Yes, we're going to pay into your account. Do you know what? To speed up the process, I actually sent them my bank details. I wouldn't normally do that, but I'm so frustrated. And that puts me at risk. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. But I'm just not willing to wait any longer now. It's been, 3.5 months? Sorry, a month on there.
No, the courts, you know, were in your favour, and you're having to sort of do all the legwork and chase this money that should just be automatically given back to you. Why do you have to chase it?
There's a query. I think I queried that with you before. I think, why is there not an automated response? You know you've received this letter from the courts. You know that money is due to the client. Shouldn't there be an automatic process that says, that doesn't issue further notice to owners, but actually rectifies the whole situation and sends a refund letter to the affected person? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. That should be an automated response. If they say that this is an automated response in error, then of course we know there's a system problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that must be addressed immediately, because I don't know how many other people have been affected. And of course, we don't know how many other people could be affected in the future. So, one of my questions to the council once, I will actually submit a complaint today and I'll copy you into that. Mm-hmm. But one of my questions to the council is going to be, do you feel that it's appropriate to continue using your current logging system for parking tickets and further actions required? Or do we need to see a wholesale system change, considering a notice to owner was sent rather than a letter confirming a refund and a request for bank details?
At the time of recording today's podcast, Medway Council had not responded to a request for a comment. The man behind plans for the multi-billion pound London resort project, dubbed the Dartford Disneyland, says it's destroyed his life. The development on the Swanscombe Peninsula was first put forward in 2012, but has suffered a series of setbacks and delays. QAT businessman Dr. Abdullah Al-Hamidi has invested millions of his own money into it and insists it could still get off the ground. A Kent dad says he's removed his autistic son from a school in Canterbury as he's been given 9 detentions since the start of term. Tim Matthews has criticised the behaviour policy at Barton Manor and claims his son, who's in year 7, is being punished for minor things. The school has been contacted for a response. A decision on whether or not to build 650 new homes on Sheppey has been delayed. The controversial scheme in Minster includes a doctor's surgery, sports facility and community hub. It's been recommended for approval, but bosses have deferred the decision over road safety and the level of developer contributions. Now, it's been revealed there are 2 potential bids which could save Folkestone Sports Centre. The site closed suddenly at the end of July as the trust that ran it could no longer afford operating costs. Campaigners are hoping the new owners will keep it as a leisure centre. Nicola has been speaking to Jim Martin, who's the leader of Folkestone and Hythe Council. He says the closure has had a huge impact on the community.
It's not only the loss of a fantastic facility, but the Sports Trust had received grant from us for many, many, many years. The council, over the lifetime of the Folkestone Sports Centre Trust, had given them over £1 million. And, you know, and everybody knew, you know, it was a poorly managed, poorly run facility. So sadly, it didn't come as a shock to us. But we can't do anything because the banks that have taken action against the trust have put them into receivership, and the receiver is now in control, and we have to wait with everybody else to see what the receiver is going to do. Now, you know, we've met the receiver, we know what's happening. I can't say too much, but I have to say I am encouraged, because I do know that there are a couple of very credible bids that are going in. Now, you know, that may all come to nothing, so I don't want to build false hope, but, you know, our fingers are crossed.
Yeah, that would be very good news. Because how concerned are you at the moment, Jim, that some people are missing out on those recreational activities, and particularly young people learning to swim as well? We heard that you mentioned the sailing activities in the sea. That's a problem. But obviously swimming is a really vital life skill, isn't it?
Absolutely essential, you know, and you know, just to be clear, all of the money that we gave to the Folkestone Sports Centre Trust was to support their swimming activities. So teaching children to swim, that's what the council paid for. We're a coastal community. It's an absolutely essential skill. So, you know, we're heartbroken over it. And everyone at the council is working very, very hard initially to get the Folkestone Sports Centre open again, get that functioning. But we are determined to improve sports facilities, and in particular, there's a particular focus of mine, swimming. We only now have one swimming pool, that's a small pool in Hythe, which is you know, battling on. It's not really fit for its purpose anymore, but it still does provide that resource. But since Folkestone has closed, of course, it's rammed to overflowing now, and people are writing to me complaining that there's too many people using it. So we're in a difficult position, but you know, I'll know more in a couple of weeks.
Kent Online News.
Air ambulance charity Kent Surrey Sussex is hoping to create an army of lifesavers this Restart a Heart Day. They want everyone to sign up to online and in-person events to learn how to give CPR in an emergency. It follows statistics that show 80% of cardiac arrests happen at home and only 1 in 10 survive. I spoke to Ben Paul, who's a paramedic at the air ambulance.
Our aircrafts and teams are awesome. We can get absolutely anywhere in the southeast of England within 30 minutes. But we know that for people who have a cardiac arrest, that's when their heart stops and is no longer pumping blood around their body, then actually every minute counts. We know that there's a 10% fall in survival for every minute that CPR is delayed. So actually, despite our aircraft being very fast, it's not quick enough for some of these patients. And therefore, we need people within the communities to essentially come forward and do bystander CPR before help arrives, whether that be us or the ambulance service.
And if a bystander has been trained and they do have these skills and they are able to intervene, what does that do to the survival rate?
So we know that bystander CPR and also the use of defibrillators, if they're available, drastically increases the rate of sort of survival. So we know that if someone's had bystander CPR and defibrillation before the ambulance arrives, it more than doubles the chances of survival. And when we look at who survives a cardiac arrest within the southeast of England, the majority of them are those that have had bystander CPR, and a small group of those who do really well are those who have had defibrillation before the ambulance arrives.
Now, it sounds a little bit daunting, you know, bystander CPR and using a defibrillator. Can you talk me through a little bit about the skills and what's required, and, you know, and just to maybe reassure everyday people like myself that that they can do it?
Yeah, of course. So I guess that's the whole idea behind the campaign, that we're trying to prove that actually it's not as intimidating and scary as what people think. We've taught children as young as 4 years old with their teddy bears how to do CPR and how to use defibrillators. We've taught all the way up to people in their 80s. And I think everyone that we teach turns around and says it's not as scary as I thought. We're not trying to get people to be experts. We're trying to get people essentially to have the confidence to step forward. We know that from the data, it's very clear that 80% of cardiac arrests happen in private residences. So that's usually people's homes. And therefore, it's likely to be friends, family, or loved ones that require this skill. And therefore, in my work, I know that people are often, you know, feel really frustrated when they've not known what to do or how to deliver that skill. And therefore, we're just giving them the confidence to try and deliver that.
Two rescue bunnies are still searching for their forever home after spending 18 months at a Kent animal shelter. Asta and Aspen are the longest staying rabbits at the RSPCA Centre in Leybourne. We've shared their picture at Kent Online. McDonald's is set to open a new restaurant in an out-of-town shopping precinct in Medway. The fast food giant is moving into Chatham's Dockside Outlet Centre, taking the place of Choice, which is moving to a bigger space. It's hoped it'll be up and running by spring. That's all from us today. Thanks ever so much for listening. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, X, Instagram, TikTok and Threads. You can also get the details on the top stories direct to your email each morning via the briefing. To sign up, just head to kentonline.co.uk.
News you can trust.
This is the Kent Online Podcast.